Welcome to Beeline, your 95 BFM news podcast, delivering straight up news.
Kia ora, and welcome to this episode of Beeline on Aotearoa's grassroots festivals. Over the past few years, a host of our festivals have gone on hiatus, wound down, or threatened to wind down if things don't change. I wanted to know what was driving this decline, and if it could be stopped or even reversed. But if not, I wanted to leave a record of these festivals to commemorate what we've had. So I reached out to organisers to get their perspective on the issues that they've had to face, and what's next for their events. To begin our journey, here's John Minty of Splore.
Kia ora, my name's John Minty, I'm director of Splore Festival.
Splore is, or was, one of, if not the seminal festival of Aotearoa's grassroots scene. I met with John in the weeks before and had the privilege to attend the festival one last time. What's it like? I'll let John do it justice.
Splore is often regarded as the best festival in the world, and that comes from overseas visitors and promoters from other big festivals in America and Europe, and obviously artists that are playing 200 or 300 times a year. They come to play Splore, and they just say without a doubt, this is the best festival in the world. You know, and they're comparing it with everything, and you go, wow, that's a big call. But it's a combination of like the land, Tapapakanga is very spiritual. It's incredible landscape. You've got a main stage right on the beach, which is pretty unique. So when the artists are playing there, they're looking out and there's people swimming around, you know, listening to them. And it's got a beautiful family vibe, very inclusive, great dancers. People love to party, good dancers. And you basically have that great combination of like 700 kids with kids' activities, sort of yoga, you know, roving performers. And as it gets darker, it just gets, you know, heavy into burlesque, raving till 6 in the morning. So it's quite a heady combination.
And from the time I've been there, there's been a whole lot of art as well.
Yeah, the art has been something that was always part of Splore going way back, which is what really impressed me about Splore originally. That's why I bought into it in 2005. And it's a non-commercial part of the festival. And a lot of festivals have featured art, but they generally drop it within a year or two because it's a cost and you don't necessarily sell tickets because of your artwork. And we've staunchly kept our art program together for the last 20 years because we feel it's a crucial and a very important, unique part of the festival.
What's the kaupapa of Splore and how did it begin?
Splore's got an amazing kaupapa. It started back in 1998, so it's 26 years, no, 28 years it's been going. And the kaupapa was very much founded on Burning Man. The founders of Splore had been to Burning Man and they loved that radical self-reliance thing, that sort of underground party vibe. They had a very strong leave no trace policy going way back then, when before it was fashionable, so you didn't leave any rubbish around. A tribe of conscious party animals was really how it started, and it's continued on that way. And the party animals have got older, so now we have three generations.
Where's Splore's journey heading to now?
Good question. So we've announced this next Splore, which is Feb 2022, as our last Splore. I've been involved with it for 20 years, and I feel that's long enough. It's a big responsibility running a big festival. And I've got, you know, Mokko's growing up, and I just feel like I need 100% less distractions. And financially, it is difficult. And this is something that obviously is relevant. The last 2 or 3 years being very difficult for festivals all around the world. And there's a number of reasons. And as festival owners, we're all trying to grapple with what those reasons are. We sort of have a pretty good idea, but we're not like totally conclusive on what it is. It seems to be a accumulation of factors. And we're scratching our heads going, why wouldn't people want to come to this beautiful experience?
All right. Before we dive into what John thinks those problems might be, I want to add a few more voices to this conversation. First up, this is Dee.
Kia ora, my name's David Tate. People call me Dee, and I'm the festival organiser and founder.
That festival he's talking about is the seminal Twisted Frequency at Takaka, which is also facing headwinds. And if he sounds exhausted, he very well might be. When we called, it was only early that day that the last things were packed off the festival site. So Dee, break it down for us. What is Twisted Frequency?
So vibes-wise, it's a big party. And that's something I like to make sure people are told explicitly, you know, in the lead up to the festival. It is a proper party. Super beautiful vibes, real community spirited and community focused event. It's an amalgamation of the underground music and art crews from all over the world and New Zealand for the most part. Musically, it's super broad. There's, you know, 4 stages, 5 days, 24 hours a day the music's playing. So we like to make sure we're servicing and providing for the broadest range of music listeners. And so it's a bit difficult to kind of list off, you know, a few genres, because I can safely say that there's most of them.
Now, Twitter's location at Cobb Valley in Takaka is beautiful, but what difficulties have you guys had recently?
So this year has been an interesting one. We faced our very first emergency situation. We had an evacuation of a third of the festival main site paddock, which meant that we had to take people away from their campsites and let them know that they weren't going to be allowed to come back until the river had dropped height. So we had an enormous amount of rain that caused a lot of other various difficulties. But it was actually a really beautiful and kind of moving experience as well, because the community really showed up in force to help keep everyone safe. We had, you know, at the moment of evacuation was like half an hour before the New Year's moment. We had 120 people all standing at attention ready to help us and ready to evacuate the festival. And they weren't all working there, you know, they were just punters and festival community members who wanted to help. And then beyond that, we had a standing guard between 15 and 20 people along the river's edge for the next 40 or so hours, protecting people from accidentally falling into the water or making their way in there on purpose. So, just the community really rose to great power as a result of the storm, and I just couldn't be more proud of everyone.
That's awesome. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of other challenges, I mean, the main one that is the talk of the town at the moment is that we have faced a massive drop in ticket sales due to the low wages and high prices in the supermarket. Essentially, the cost of living has just absolutely gutted a huge portion of the underground festival world, and it's meaning low ticket sales for some really beautiful events that aren't going to be able to continue unless something changes. So that's the most drastic challenge we've ever faced.
And you'd say you're in that position right now with Twisted. If things don't change, it wouldn't be sustainable to continue?
Yeah, this is what I've let people know in a very public way, which has been a pretty hearty and difficult time. But if the festival doesn't improve in sales this coming New Year's, it will be the end of it. Because, you know, there's one thing being in debt for 7 or 8 years that I have been already, but there's another being in the kind of debt I'm looking at right now. There's just not a way to overcome the scale of deficit that something like that can do to a festival. And I'm pretty resilient.
Right. The next voice to enter the fray is Rob Warner. He's a DJ, industry advocate, and also does the marketing at OM Festival.
Rob Warner. I'm a DJ, industry advocate, and also do the marketing at OM Festival.
Listeners, to lay my cards on the table, OM is where I've spent my last 2 New Years. So how has it been holding up behind the scenes? Is it all smooth sailing?
I mean, the big challenges in the last couple of years have been, fast rising costs of running festivals, which is also paired with increased living costs for people who might buy tickets. So, you know, people are starting to get more picky about what they do, whether it's fitness, pastimes, holidays, whatever, or whether they're focusing on debt, mortgages, paying off their car, credit card, whatever. So, you know, festivals are having to be very, very clear and put together a very compelling pitch as to the mythology and memories that they create and offer so that people choose to spend, you know, their money with them.
So weather, ticket sales and the economy. What else do we have?
I mean, a festival experience is very unique. I think a lot of festivals will struggle because during COVID, a lot of the young kids who would have become the festival goers in the future never experienced going out at all, you know, during their formative years of 15 to maybe 18. So there's a bit of a disconnect there with that young crowd, not used to going to festivals, not even used to going out, actually. And it might take a while for them to sort of, you know, understand the concept of, like, living in a tent for 3 days and not sleeping and having a great time.
Yeah, I know, as myself in that sort of demographic, I've had to introduce people sort of kicking and screaming to it. And,
yes.
You know, obviously they have a great time once they get out there, but...
This is the ironic thing, is I've had a number of friends over the years who said, there's no way I'm going to come to your festival. I'm not living in a tent for a weekend. And I'm saying, just do it. And sometimes it takes them 8 years. They finally do it. And they said, that was the best time of my life. Why did I not come 8 years ago? So the sacrifice is worth it.
So we might better add the generational impacts of COVID to the issues facing festivals. But what else?
Yeah, tickets is, it's interesting because Splore prior to COVID had sold out early on all the Splores. I think 6 Splores leading up to COVID we'd sold out. For the 18 years I had Splore, never lost money, like always profitable, sometimes a minimal profit, but it was always profitable. And then 2024, the ticket sales just didn't lift at all. And that was the first year we didn't really have that buoyant market for ticket sales. And we were scratching our heads going, oh, maybe it'll come the last few weeks, but it just didn't happen. And we put it down at the time primarily to the cost of living crisis. A lot of our punters are in their 30s and 40s, their families, they own homes, interest rates were very high at that stage. And that was the prime reason, and the general economic climate. And I think that was probably the main reason. I can point to competition. There's always competition over summer for, you know, big shows coming through Auckland. And I think, I think cost of living probably the main thing. And also the financial struggle relates to cost as well. Costs on production, and particularly for international artists, have skyrocketed in the last few years, which has made it very difficult for anyone doing a Greenfields festival, where you have to load in all your generators, your toilets, everything. And also, you know, if you're having an international artist, they've virtually tripled in price in the last few years.
With festivals facing this tough moment at this point in time, spending is down, costs are up. In a case like this, could the government have done more to support Splore?
Yeah, I honestly believe that. I mean, I have been running my own companies for over 40 years. I'm not into handouts, and I believe that a private enterprise company, you take the risk, you know, you lose or you win. But having said that, with the struggles with all of our cultural things, you know, whether it's a live music venue or whether it's a dance troupe or a festival, particularly a festival like a Splore or an Om or a WOMAD, where they are actually very iconic cultural events. It's not just an international artist playing on a stage for a few hours and everyone goes back to a hotel. You know, these are communities that have been evolved. Like Splore's been going 28 years, so we're into 3 generations. So it's a massive cultural event. And I would argue that something like Splore, where we have a lot of non-commercial elements to our program, like our artwork, whare tapiri with the local iwi, our workshops for children, spoken word, all that's non-commercial. So I think those elements of a festival, which WOMAD have, I think have a good case to be funded. You know, the non-commercial, not so much money from the government to be able to afford an international artist to come down from England where all the money heads off overseas. Splore generates about $3 million. 90% of that goes to local community, all local contractors. Our international artist budget is relatively small, so we're pumping a lot of money into the economy. As I say, international visitors that come to Splore say this is the most amazing festival. So it showcases New Zealand, it showcases our indigenous culture. Why wouldn't the government want to support something like that? You know, they just put millions into, you know, sponsoring getting the surf tournament down to Raglan from Jay Bay, which I'm a fan of. I'm a massive surfer, so I don't have a massive problem with that. But they are spending millions to do it. And I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. That's just one event at Raglan for surfing, which I love, don't get me wrong. But, you know, even a fraction of that amount of money for Splore would have probably had more impact in terms of international visitors and the impact on perception of New Zealand.
I've seen you speak in other interviews about this government fund that they launched this year. That, you know, you mentioned the Raglan Surf. Another one that you brought up before was Linkin Park receiving subsidized $800 tickets. I'd love for you to speak on this here. How do you feel about that?
I think it was a knee-jerk reaction. I felt there was some pressure from the industry that the government had to do something. The governments, state and federal in Australia, also in England, they have been providing good funding for festivals because they understand the importance of that culture. And I think the current government felt there was a bit of pressure to actually do something. And I think that the money, they had $70 million. And I think the events they supported, I think a lot of it had a bit of a political overtone to it. I don't think they thought it through in the sense that the money they were pumping in there wasn't going to attract international visitors. If that was the basis of the funding, there's not international visitors going to come to see Ultra in Wellington or Linkin Park in Auckland. I mean, they're doing shows all around the world, so where's the rationale there? I'm not bad-mouthing, and I think that government should support all those sort of events, but I think they needed to be a bit more selective. And they did, in fact, sponsor and provide money for a lot of cultural events. I think the Taranaki Light Festival might have got some funding, for example. So there were quite a few that did get funding, which I would have thought that's fine. But I think, you know, your grassroots festivals that are doing it hard because they don't have international backing. These are locally owned, entrepreneurial, young people trying to make a difference and create a culture here. And all the money is going back into our local community. And I think they're the sort of events that government should be funding. And we've gone for central government funding before over the last few years, and we've never got it, which I find quite surprising.
Could you give us some sort of perspective on those large organisers, those large promoters, those large companies? How big are we talking? Just so our listeners get an understanding of the comparison going on here.
Well, I mean, to put it this way, if I could bring it to a very current example, Linkin Park is coming here, and it's been pitched as an event that wouldn't have come to New Zealand otherwise, unless the government gave them some money to bring it here. But the truth is, the entire global tour of over 60 concerts is being organised by Live Nation, who are a $50 billion American company. And they put their hand out and the government gave them money straight away to bring Linkin Park over here, even though they are the gatekeepers because they organised the entire tour. Now, I don't see any good rationale for that being anything other than the government having been taken for a ride. And people should be annoyed about that when events like Spore get told no to very, very comparatively small amounts of funding just so they can make it through the tough 1 or 2 years and survive until the economy bounces back and people have a bit more disposable income. Spore is a cultural juggernaut and it should be valued and its history should be valued. And if it disappears, which seems likely, that will be a tragic thing. But if Linkin Park comes here, everyone will have forgotten about it in 5 days, except for the person who collected all the money. I mean, I don't think anyone can credibly make the argument that straight after 6 or 8 concerts in Australia, a bunch of people are going to fly over to see them in Auckland. It may be a small amount of people, but, you know, in terms of lasting economic impact, zero. I think you can make the argument that it's actually zero, especially given all of the profits for that event are taken offshore. None of it's invested back in the local economy. Whereas Spore, the vast majority of their even revenue is invested back in the local economy, and ditto for most other New Zealand-owned festivals. So, you know, maybe with something like Ultra Festival, you could say, hey, it will bring people here and it will put Wellington on the map and people will fly over from Australia because to the best of my knowledge, Australia doesn't have an Ultra Festival coming up. You know, I can see the argument for that, but I want to see the argument. I don't want this just to be an election year warm, fluffy story dishing out of money when, you know, money could be more smartly spent through lots and lots of smaller grants to arts-based festivals rather than just giving it to huge, huge, huge companies.
There are people out there who would make the case that we wouldn't have as many artists and musicians were it not for the grassroots festival scene giving them that space to grow and find an audience.
Yes, yes, and this is the point I've made many times before, is that the smaller grassroots events feed up into the music ecosystem by helping people get this experience or exposure, whereas larger events do not feed down. They don't support the small artists in any meaningful way. They don't support nurturing artists. They don't support the ecosystem. It is a financial transaction and consideration, and that's it. And that's why I always distinguish events into things that are arts and culture focused and things which are checkbook and balance sheet focused. And it's an important point to make that when you see large events crying out for money, they are not supporting grassroots culture or growth or new artists. And they leave all that heavy lifting to all of the smaller events who take larger proportional risks all the time, and they do it out of love for music and art. And at some point, if they start falling over, then you end up with bland corporate events only dominating the market space. And that's not good for anything.
And compared to the larger, more corporate organizers such as Live Nation, how much of a personal financial risk grassroots organizers putting themselves at to host a festival if it doesn't go well?
It's a huge risk because, like I say, there's a lot of costs involved in doing a festival. Generally, they start in New Zealand like Splore started. We all just got in together. We didn't pay ourselves any money. We got all our friends to help out. And that's pretty well the only way you can do it. You've got to mate with a good PA. And that's the way most underground festivals start. But then, you know, you might get a bit of demand and you sell a few tickets, and then you people go, well, I've done this for free for the last 5 years. Can I have some money now? And then it becomes a bit of a crunch. But I think, yeah, it's hard because you've got... And it's not just New Zealand, it's internationally. You've got some very big companies, you know, like your TEGs, your Live Nations, who dominate those industries, and they buy up a lot of festivals. And they also control a lot of the artists. They control, obviously, the ticketing through Ticketmaster in the case of Live Nation, vertical integration, venues. So for a smaller festival, you can survive as a small festival, I feel, as a grassroots one. But as soon as you pop your head up a bit higher and try to become a medium-sized festival, you're going to have some real challenges.
Yes, I've seen other people mention that, you know, New Zealand festivals like this one, these more grassroots festivals that showcase New Zealand artists, they create an industry atop them. You know, the big commercial festivals, your Electric Avenues, your RNAs or R&Vs, they are built up into through these festivals that are willing to take on New Zealand artists and give them a risk and showcase them.
Yeah, Splore has been well known for showcasing local artists and getting them to step up. We've had a lot of artists that I've put onto the main stage at prime times, local artists, and that's been their first opportunity to play a big stage in front of a good audience. I only do that because I know they're really good and they can deliver, but I'm happy to take that punt. And they really appreciate that. And that's a real launch pad for a lot of New Zealand artists that come to Splore, and they get incredible feedback from those sort of performances.
Now, here's a smaller festival that platformed local artists but didn't survive under these conditions. This is Mia from Welcome to Nowhere.
Kia ora koutou. My name's Mia, and I was on the organising team for Aga Music Collective for our festival Welcome to Nowhere.
So, what's the elevator pitch for Welcome to Nowhere? What's it got going on?
I would say Welcome to Nowhere is a wonderful festival focused on local artists from around the country. We showcase like art, comedians, all forms of music. We kind of try and cover as many genres as we can.
With Welcome to Nowhere, how long did it run?
We ran them from 2017. So we ran about 7 festivals, with I think about 1 being cancelled by COVID.
And will there be a Welcome to Nowhere in the foreseeable future, next year, this year?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. We kind of briefly considered attempting a comeback last year, but we kind of agreed that it was still like too risky of an environment to try and start back up a festival. Tickets aren't selling. People are struggling to afford camping and festival tickets. A lot of people have left the country as well. It's just, it's terrifying. It can be so scary, you know, just like the worry that you're going to launch something and, you know, run a festival and not be able to pay anyone for like the incredible mahi they've done for you over that weekend. So yeah, we had like pretty huge discussions about it, but I think there was other things going on with the collective. We had ran our last festival as our last festival. We were still in quite a lot of debt from running the festival and making huge losses on that. So it was still like just a bit too much risk to try and put on a fest. And if we still lost out in the end, like there's one thing as well, is like you can calculate and budget like how well a festival's going to go. But if you have like a PA system explode that you weren't prepared for, that's like so much money.
It takes you out.
yeah, shuttle van like breaks down or something that you were hiring, that's easy 5K, you know, things like that. So when you're thinking, when we're thinking about these things, we really need to think about like, what's the worst thing that could happen? And would we be okay if it did?
What were the major difficulties in putting it on? What did it take?
I don't know. I think with running festivals, there's like so many issues, and each year you fix some of the issues and then you discover new issues, you know. I think an ongoing issue aside from money was weather. Our site was not very well built to deal with heavy rain and flooding, and so it was quite hard to keep all of the tracks for people to explore around or travel from stage to stage kind of safe. Also keeping all of your gear dry. I mean, it's a lot of people power to get it organised. I think we had about a team of 10 people working on it to get it all together. And then funding is definitely, like, I would say you're one of the biggest struggles, just knowing how you're going to afford everything. Wanting to put on something that is super fun, enjoyable, everyone's well looked after, and also like making sure you're putting in the money to keep things safe for people as well, bringing in your like harm reduction teams, know your stuff, security and things like that.
In this current environment, with great festivals struggling to sell tickets, is there anyone trying out new ideas to reduce risk?
Yeah, so Blink, who runs Camp Aloham Festival, he brought it back, I think, in 2024? And that went pretty well, but I think as well he's also recognised the kind of where we're all at as festival curators and organisers of how risky it can be to put so much money into a startup of a festival that doesn't sell in the end. So he announced that he was going to run Camp Aloham again next year, I believe, in 2027. Yeah, he wanted to sell a certain amount of tickets in order to guarantee that that festival would go forward, which I thought was pretty smart.
So, who is Blink and what is Camp Aloham?
My real name's Ian Jorgensen, though I guess most people in the music industry would know me as Blink.
And with Camp Aloham, what's the vibe? What are people walking into?
I think they're kind of walking into a discovery mode. So it's very much built into the entire ethos of the event, the entire time it's been going, that you're not really knowing what you're going to find, but you just trust that I've done it well for lots of years and that people rave about it, so you assume it's going to be good. But there's just a lot of trust between the people who come along and me, and you know, I also know not to, you know, fuck up that trust. Like, I take it very seriously, and so that's why I spend all my time just listening to bands and going to shows to try and find the stuff that people don't know about.
What makes it different from other festivals?
Oh, I mean, there's so many things. I guess the most obvious things are that, yeah, I don't announce any lineup, so no one knows. You know, until they arrive at the event and they get a booklet with who's playing, they have no idea what's going on. Pretty much all of the bands play twice. There'll be some exceptions to that. There'll be like some, you know, international artists, whatever, who just don't have enough time, or, you know, they're like way too big to play in a small room. That would be riots. But generally, most of the bands play twice. There's no backstage areas. There's no green rooms. There's no VIP areas. So everybody is on a level playing field. This includes the bands as well as people. Everyone is in it together. And also every single stage is viewable from all directions. Bands play in the round. So generally they're facing each other, or even if they're not facing each other, people, the attendees can stand in 360 all around every stage. There's no backs to the stage. So it's presented in a radically different fashion to most other events.
And Camp Aloham took a break, am I right? And now that it's returning, you've introduced a new model for how it works. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if... Are you talking about the people paid way in advance?
Yeah, then, okay, yeah.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, that wasn't how the last one worked in 2024, but then basically I was kind of stupid, and I'd done this, so I took 10 years off to work on this other project since Stremaudible and a bunch of other music-related things. And then basically because the first period of camps took about 8 years, and then it had been 10 years off, so I looked at all my prices and budgets from the first camp and then the seventh camp, and I was like, okay, well, I assume that inflation would have been pretty similar over that period as to the next period, so why didn't I just like assume those price increases from 2014 and just like nudge it up a little bit more? Was I so wrong? So, I mean, I put those tickets on sale assuming that, you know, like inflation was like a little bit over that period, but inflation was crazy over that period. So even though I sold out in 2024, I still lost a bunch of money because, like, production's just out of control expenses. Now, at that event, people were just, like, you know, losing their minds and just desperate for me to do another one. But I was also like, well, you know, I mean, I can't just do another one and lose some more money. So if you want me to do another one, it's going to be another $100 more expensive. And because I wasn't sure if people were prepared to pay that, I didn't want to take the risks. So I kind of, you know, because it's not my responsibility. It's like, I don't necessarily want it to happen. Everybody else wanted it to happen. If they want it to happen, I will facilitate it because I love doing it. But I just didn't want to lose more money. So, yeah, I just put it on the people to take the responsibility. And they proved that they wanted it to happen. They all bought tickets at $100 more expensive in like a couple of days. So I said, yeah, I'll do another one.
So are you funding it out of pocket?
Yeah, totally. But thankfully, the company that I spent that 10 years building did pretty well. So I was okay to take a bit of a hit financially myself. But I mean, and also, it was a pretty small hit. Like, we're not talking like the massive amount of money that, like, you know, stuff like Twisted and 121 and the stuff that those guys lost. Like, we're talking like, you know, I maybe lost like 5 to 10 grand at the end of the day. And that was only because I chose to lose that money because basically I saw my staff getting like run off their feet the first weekend. So I just threw money at a whole bunch of like temporary staff and just like bought in a whole bunch of stuff that second weekend just to kind of like ease up the pressure. It's like, you know, I could have been a dick and not lose money. But I was just like, nah, you know, it's fine to listen to me lose. But also, you must think out, I worked for like 2 years on that event and then still lost five, 10 grand.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the thing is a lot of people don't understand is that when these other events lose like 200 grand, it's not only that loss of 200 grand, but it's that year of like a lot of staff working that event who didn't get paid or, you know, got paid peanuts. So it's actually a much greater loss, you know.
With the changes that you've made with Camp Aloham, getting people to commit to paying up front before the organizing goes into it, do you think that's made it more sustainable?
Yeah, in theory, my event is already broken even. I mean, obviously, stuff could go wrong. You know, I have a contingency fund to allow for, you know, a few things that can crop up, you know, because stuff crops up. In 2014, the rain that I had ended up, like, taking away any money that that event would have made, just all got washed away, bad pun. But, you know, you have these last minute costs rise up all the time. So I don't know if the event's going to do well. Hopefully it will do well, and then it gets to fund the winter fund while putting more money into this winter fund project I'm doing.
Could you introduce us to the winter fund? What is the project?
Yeah, no worries. I mean, basically, I'd pretty much kind of tapped out of working in the music industry after sort of that break to work on this other project. But then when Ruben passed, and it just kind of like, I guess it woke me up to like, oh, when I left the music industry, I realized I didn't really make a more active way in like identifying really talented people and kind of like really tried to nurture and mentor them into a place where they can kind of do what I was doing. So that was kind of where the Winter Fund came in, you know, trying to like help nurture that next, you know, season of promoters and people doing cool shit.
So who is this targeted at? Is it bands? Is it organizers? What scale are we looking at? What's going on here?
Well, so currently the sort of, you know, tiny application process I have is targeted at the moment for people who have put on a few shows, they've done a few parties, they're starting to build a little community, they might have a brand, and they just want to sort of like maybe branch out into going outside of bars. So it's like the very, very first funding level is just like $1,000 to help you put on your first party outside of a bar. So, you know, it's not for people with like 500,000 to 600,000 people, whatever. It's like, hey, maybe there's like 100 people at your like local scout hall or whatever. But it's just enough money to pay for hall hire, pay for a PA, pay for an engineer, pay for a poster, and then, you know, you've got those core costs out of the way, and then, you know, so you don't have to lie awake at night, like I was saying, and stress out about, like, trying to break even. To go on tour, you don't have to get, like, $15,000 from Creative New Zealand. It's literally just, like, $1,000. It makes a massive difference in, like, a small creative project. You know, and this is the kind of thing I was like going, oh yeah, this is what's missing. Because a lot of young people, they don't have that $1,000, you know, they don't have that money spare, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck, you know, paying their rent, the rent's going crazy. So it's like, if you come in and say, hey, look, I can just help you take that next step, then that might be all that they need.
So new ways of funding festivals, new ideas. I want to return to John now to see what he has to say about people who might come after him. Do you have any advice for people who might be following in your footsteps, who are thinking about, you know, maybe they're hosts of small festivals or they've hosted small festivals and they're thinking of stepping up into that medium size? What are those troubles?
Yeah, I mean, my gut feel is that there's definitely a market here for it. And I think we do really well. I mean, you consider the size of New Zealand, how many festivals we have, how many big international acts actually come through Auckland. It's staggering. I mean, we probably have more variety of stuff here in our summer than New York has, like when you look at it. And it's, you know, it's mainly because of Australia. Australia's got a lot of money. They pay a lot of big money for international artists. So quite often we get piggybacked onto that. So I think there's always going to be great events in New Zealand, but that creates a problem for a medium-sized, locally owned festival because, you know, we had Splore going really well, you know, and then I think one year Prince decided to do do a show, I think the Thursday before Splore. One year we had Eminem, like, you know, announced the show at Western Springs on our weekend. So just little things like that, you lose, say, 500 tickets, and that's your difference between your profit and loss.
So if you're a smaller independent organizer without the backing of a huge corporation, a cost like that sounds like it could be fatal.
Yes, it can be, and it's often proven to be the case. I think people that have done it very well have been Mitch and Toby, you know, have done Bay Dreams, Audiology and Trademark. I heard Mitch being interviewed saying, yeah, you can lose like seven figures in one and then you bounce back and make seven figures on the next one. So you need to have deep pockets to take the big loss to bounce back and do another one. So you need to have a lot of business going through, like Mitch and Toby or Alive Nation. It's like the old adage, you can lose money on 8 out of 10 events, but you make enough money on the 2 out of 10 to actually make it all worthwhile. But you've got to have deep pockets to run those 10 events.
I think one really beautiful thing that we have in New Zealand amongst the festival scene with all of our like local smaller team festivals is just the amount of support and encouragement that we have for each other. I think it's really important and really wonderful how much everyone is willing to support each other, especially in the hard times that we're in and trying to keep, you know, creating community events and creating opportunities for people to connect and, you know, do their passions. It's so special that we do what we can to support each other within all of that. And big shout out to all the festivals that are still pulling through, still doing their best to keep it running for everyone. And yeah, support your local.
Yeah.
Go to Twisted Frequency.
D, is there anything you want to add as we wrap up?
Yeah, I'd love to just touch on another thing that we are doing to try and save the event, and that's fundraising. We've never really dabbled in this before, but right now I'm being overwhelmed with an amazing and beautiful just inundation of messages and emails and people getting in touch with me and supporting the festival in the ways that they can. So at this stage, it's looking like minimum 25 different fundraising events are being planned all over the world. And our first one just got launched. It's going to be at the Whakamana Cannabis Museum from this amazing ambient crew. Yeah, there's just like so much support flowing out of the wider community. We're going to have shows in Berlin, Nuremberg, you know, California, right across Australia, several in every state, and then a fierce chunk of them in New Zealand as well. So I guess if I can call to action any of your listeners, it would be have a look at our socials, see ways that we're fundraising. We're doing a bunch of competitions with the support of small businesses across New Zealand and the world, and that's like a way that you can donate a little bit, but also go to win some really fabulous prizes. We're going to be releasing some albums, some like Bandcamp EPs, compilations from all of our biggest name acts, mix in with some of the key up-and-comers that we really want to platform. There's lots of ways that we're trying to get ourselves actively out of this situation. And yeah, any contributions from the wider community, be that attending one of our gigs, find an album, getting into the competition, all of those things can really help us just get back to zero so that we can figure out what on earth we're going to do from here. Thanks again, BFM, for your support, and much love, ka kite. I'm going to go build the next festival now.
Ka kite. John, is there anything you'd like to say to send it off?
Yeah, I would like to Yeah, I'd just like to celebrate the culture and the community we've developed with Splore. I feel a little bit bad, you know, wrapping it up. Tickets are selling really well now, mainly because we announced that it was the last Splore. So the 100,000 people that have probably been to Splore over the last 20 years are going, oh, maybe we should go for one last time. So I think financially this one's going to be fine. But it's a shame that I had to say it was the last Splore to get it there. It's going to be a great celebration. And I think the legacy of Splore is huge. You know, I think people are going to be talking about Splore for years to come, you know, as a legendary event. It's affected so many people's lives. You know, kids have grown up with Splore who are now adults, and it's affected them in a very positive way. So I'm very proud of that legacy, and I hope something like Splore can be resurrected and continue on. I would have personally loved Splore to carry on for another 20 years, even if I wasn't involved.
Well, as one of those kids, thank you very, very much. And
My pleasure.
All the best for the future.
Thank you. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
Cheers, man.
I'd like to say a warm thank you to all of our guests for this episode. John Minty from Splore, Dee from Twisted Frequency, Rob Warner from Om, Mia from Welcome to Nowhere, and Blink from Aloham. Ka kite.
Thanks for listening to Beeline, your 95 BFM news podcast, delivering straight up news.